when I decided I wanted to become an Olympic gold medal. The passion was, and the plan was, to restore Canada's pride from the 88 Olympics and bring back some pride and joy to Canadian hearts. I got so pissed. I took the table, boom! Oh. You kiss my son of a, I almost dropped my pants. And I said, don't you ever, ever tell me my dream is over. Who the hell for you to tell me this, right? I went off, man. I said, you're a little dream killer. And watch out. I'm going to come back with my gold medal and push it down your throat. You hear me? Get out of here. And I left.
Wow. Oh,
I had a little mouth on me. I had fire, right? So that hurt so much, knowing that the hard work, the sacrifice and stuff. And this guy who don't know anything about me going to tell me it's over, this and that. Let's move on, whatever. Right? Didn't do his homework. Top six is on a relay squad. There's a glimmer of hope, folks. Right? I got Jesus. I don't know what he's got. Right? I'm coming. So anyway, make a long story short, you know, I showed him the gold medal when I came back.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a speaker and coach. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. Today's interview is with the awesome and hilarious Robert Esme, Jamaican by way of Ontario, Canada, along with Bruni Searing, Glenroy Gilbert, and Donovan Bailey of the Canadian 4x100 relay team, the top relay team in the world from 94 to 99, two-time world champion, 1996 Olympic gold medalist in at the Atlanta Summer Olympics, a world bronze medalist in the 60 meter. So charismatic and so thoughtful, had a deep conviction to be an Olympic champion and an amazing self-belief in himself. Originally wasn't chosen to be one of the four men for the relay, but listen to his inside story in 1996, how he was left off the team as an alternate and then comes on. Now, coming in that kind of position, you might be, you know, hesitant to assert yourself, and most people would probably just toe the line, but he comes in with air blast off shaved into his head. Sounds ridiculous, but listen to why he did it. It shows just an amazing insight, and that act gave the team in the Olympics, helped them to win gold. It's incredible. I hope you enjoy this interview. My hope after listening to this podcast is that you will learn something about plan, purpose, and passion, because today's guest is Robert Esme. He's a multiple world champion at the 4x100 meter relay, as well as an Olympic gold medalist from the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. He's in both the Olympic Hall of Fame and the Canada Sports Hall of Fame. He's coached athletes to the NCAA, NFL, and the Olympics. That's why he's called the Speed Doctor. I'm so excited to talk with you, Mr. Robert Esme.
I'm excited to be interviewed by you. Well-researched, great personality. So I'm looking forward to building a relationship.
So Robert, as we start off, I'm wondering if you can just describe your career kind of in your own words, just briefly.
It was exciting. I remember my first race. I trained in Sudbury Arena. I grew up here in Sudbury after coming from Jamaica. I think I arrived in April 84, and I remember it was like 26 degrees when I left Jamaica. And when I landed in Sudbury, it was minus 26. I thought I was on another planet. It's the first time I saw white people. I was like,
oh, really?
What's going on here? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was culture shock, everything. But, you know, the warmth of the people of Sudbury allowed me to settle in a lot better. It was some challenges for myself for a couple of years, but the people itself was great. I came to love Sudbury. No matter where I go in the world, I always tell people Sudbury, Sudbury, Sudbury. And they're like, what? Where's the nickel? Sudbury! Yeah, but overall, you know, I remember I ran my first race, and I ran a 40-meter dash. I trained for very hard, and at the time, the coach was like, oh, that would have been a world record. And I said, I guess it's a world record. I'm Jamaican. Hello. So I trained after that. And I remember running an indoor race in York University.
Yeah.
And at the time, Ben Johnson, everybody was there in the race. And in lane one was a little skinny guy in high school, and everybody was ran on the Olympic team. The Zai Williams, a whole stack of them, Tony Sharp, right? And I remember I pulled off a third place there, and my peers lost it in the stadium. And after that, I said, yep, we're going to go break some world records and do some great things. So that was my bug on getting into track and field.
That's awesome. And as I stand back and I look at your career, you have a number of great leadership attributes that I think have led to success, both on the track and in business, in your life. And one of these is the passion that you have, but not just passion, but you have no problem expressing it because you're very secure in your own skin. You have a positive way of looking at life and at your career, and some notable brands you've got are Air Blast Off and the Speed Doctor. And so today, sometimes we can be concerned about what other people might think and kind of let it, you know, like press back and keep us back from being ourselves. But what's your view on this? Because you really seem to embrace this, and I'll flash some of your social media sites as we chat here.
I always say, if you speak to your truth and you stay to your truth, you'll be in the right direction. And, you know, for me, when it comes to planning, I plan for success. We always say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Mm-hmm. And no matter what all the obstacles, I remember when I decided I wanted to become an Olympic gold medal. The passion was, and the plan was, to restore Canada's pride from the 88 Olympics and bring back some pride and joy to Canadian hearts, bring back the distaste of the media, who ridiculed Jamaica as well in that process. And I remember going to my mother and I said, Mom, you know, I want to do track and I want to restore some of this that was tainted. Going through high school, I raced Carl Lewis, I think, when I was in grade 9.
Yeah.
I flew to Martinique, got into the race. I got dead last. And I was like, wow, Carl Lewis, right? Ochidi Omomo, all these guys, right? I got dead last in the race. So that was, that was 1991. And then I progressed and watched. And in 1993, I lined up against Carl Lewis again in Stuttgart in the 100-meter quarterfinals and the second round. And I was in lane 3, and he looked over, he's in 5. So I said, Mr. Lewis, you don't remember me, do you? He goes, who the hell are you? I said, I'm the Flash. Back then, I went by the Flash, right? I said, I'm the Flash. Cameras try to slow down and capture me, right? So he goes, uh-huh, whatever. So the gun went, came flying out the block, 60 meter. I'm on top of Carl Lewis, ahead of him, right? 80 meter. I feel his long legs start coming through my side view mirrors, right? And then, boom, crossed the line. I went 10:23. He goes, who are you? I said, the Flash. He said, this is the fastest and hardest I've ever ran in a quarter rounds, man, to meet you. Right? So ever since then, I became the Flash. So those are some of the fun stories where, with the planning that I would put in place, I was able to travel, do a lot more, because dreams cost money. We know that. Some cost more, some cost less. And I wanted to give myself an opportunity to be able to have no other option but to fly anywhere I want, do whatever I want, and maintain my grades at the same time, because my mom required to have good grades to travel. So that was part of the process of my planning.
Man, that's awesome. And for those viewers and listeners that might not know, Carl Lewis, a very famous Olympian with many, many medals.
Oh, world record holder.
World record holder, absolutely, from the United States, yeah. Now, Robert, all great leaders have amazing vision. In the Sudbury Star, you're quoted as saying, I have a vision that you could make dreams happen anywhere. And you've talked about that a little bit.
That's right.
Some of the stuff that maybe we don't see at the time is the stuff that you had to overcome. You trained in a hockey arena. You ran outside in the snow. and amazingly, you trained yourself in the Olympic year.
Yeah.
So how did you maintain your vision, you know, so far ahead, when it just seems like there's a lot of barriers, a lot of, you know, friction that's trying to slow you down?
Well, absolutely. You know, I always say it makes the victory sweeter, you know, and I remember I think it was 94. I went to see one of the world's greatest massage therapists. I call him the Doctor of Hands. They call him Magic Man, Waldemar Matuszewski. I remember I went down and saw him on the massage table, and he's got his hand-built machines that he did to tone the muscles, goes inside the muscles, layer it down, and put everything together. And I remember that year, I was feeling great. I think the year before, I went, ran the fastest 50 meter in the world, 5:62, right? And it stood as number one time in the world at that
time. Very fast.
Through the whole indoor season. So I went back to him to fine tune it. I said, you know what? I want the world record in the 50, right? So I went and saw him and got a tune up. It's just like after a season, you go like a car, you go in to take it apart. Before season starts, you go back in to clean everything, all the joints and ligaments, and put it all back together. So when I left that table, I called a press conference and says, I'm going to break the world record in Hamilton. And I left Ottawa on my way to Sudbury. The car broke down midnight, like dead dark. I'm by myself. I'm like, what am I going to do? It's minus 30 something. It was January. And luckily, this guy pulls up with his wife behind me. And he was coming from church. And he says, young man, I'm going to help you. I said, yes, I don't have CA at the time. So he took me to his house, him and his wife, made me dinner. And we prayed. And he called CAA and got my vehicle to the shop, got it fixed, took care of it. And then I drove home. So on the way home, I got my stuff ready. I said, Mom, I'm going to Hamilton. I'm going to go break this world record. And on the way down to Hamilton, right at Major McKenzie by Canada's Wonderland, there was this bridge and this wall. Some guy cut me off in a slush and my car spun, hit the wall, and spin back out while cars were coming down. I was like, oh my God. I started praying, our Father, who art in heaven. I started bringing out all my biblical stuff that I was learning through the whole different religions.
You save them up for a time like that.
Yeah. And then the funny thing is, in the back seat of my car was a picture frame that I was bringing from my sister. The glass shattered and stick directly in the back of my seat, right from my head. And at the time, all I'm hearing the music skip. I'm like, oh, my stereo. I was enjoying the music too, you know. And I said, thank you, Father. And then, you know, I got to the meet in Hamilton and I felt okay that day. And by the next day, before the meet start, my body started locking down because of the impact. And I end up second to Bruni Cern. But my body was so fine-tuned mentally and everything, I was ready for that world record. And I remember driving back down with my mom, and I said, this is the wall that I hit. She goes, you know what? Your father hit the same wall, and that is why you're here today, because he was looking out for you. So every time I drive to Toronto, even my son, I said, Daddy, Grandpa hit that wall, and Daddy hit that wall, and we're alive because Daddy was looking out for me. Right? Oh. So it was just amazing. But the mindset and the spiritual connection, because I'm a spiritual person, and when my spirit is off, everything's off. It's about balance, right? So the faith and the vision and the passion, right, to succeed, it's amazing, because you have to see the end results. For me, when I plan, I see the end, and then I move backwards. You know, when people said, you're going to win a gold medal, they laughed at me because I said, I already saw myself on the podium in 96 getting a gold medal. I've already envisioned the time that was going to run in the Olympics, 9.69, right? That's what I said. I was going to run 9.69, and I did the poster. But on the poster, I ran out of room, so it said 9.6. So when you deal with hand time, which is 9.6, and you turn that into electronic time, you always add 0.24. So if you go 9.6 plus 0.24 equals what?
9.24.
What was the world record?
Yeah, that was the world record.
9.84. And what did that color medal did that win? Gold. Yeah. So I was like, that was supposed to be mine. So when I went to the Olympic trials and I was coming from the accident still and I couldn't breathe and move because I was ranked third in the country, right? And at the rounds, I went 10-1. Bruni went 10-1, won his. Glenware won 10-1 and won his. Carlton went 10-1, and Donovan, we all went 10-1, all five of us. So now top three gets the individual spot, top six come part of the relay squad, right? So I remember I went into the race, and I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move in the finals. And I said, Jesus, please take me home. Help me through this. And I asked the starter, I said, can I start standing up? And he's like, no, the rule says everybody down. And I said, I can't breathe. I can't move. Uh-huh. And he said, Robert, we love you, but this is the rules. You have to abide by it. And I remember, and I said to myself, I said, Jesus, I look up. I said, listen, we need to make a deal here. I said, I told people 4 years ago, I made posters, I made promises, I'm going to win a gold medal. We need to do something, right? And I said, I'll be the best boy. I keep my mouth quiet. I'll just show up and just do my stuff. So anyway, I prayed and got into the blocks. And I remember the starter says, gentlemen, on your marks. And I'd shake the legs and, you know, going down slowly into the blocks and crimping pain and everything. And the starter says, set. And I was in so much pain, it took a while to get in the set position. And then when the gun fired, I saw everybody took off. And I felt, I finally came out of the blocks, but they were ahead of me. And I remember the track, the first 40 meter was a different color because they resurfaced it. And then the 60 onwards was a different color density. Okay. I remember they were gone past the second color. I was still way in the first. And I think I reached 60 meter and something took over my body because I went from last place and start move up to seventh, six. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm running out of real estate. And I pulled into the fifth position and crossed the line and I came fifth. And I remember I'm jumping for joy. Although I wanted the 100 meters so bad I could have tasted it, but I realized something. I still have a chance to get a gold medal because I'm still on the team. Right? I remember I came home and I did a press interview and conference and stuff. And I remember one reporter says, you suck. Your dream sucks. This. And man, my father passed away and I never cried. My grandmother, who I loved dearly, passed away. I never cried. That day, that man made me cry.
Right there.
And it was like watching the Hulk Hogan, the Hercules. I got so pissed. I took the table, boom! Oh. You kissed my son of a... Oh! I almost dropped my pants. And I said, don't you ever, ever tell me my dream is over. Who the hell for you to tell me this, right? I went off, man. I said, you're a little dream killer. And watch out. I'm going to come back with my gold medal and push it down your throat. You hear me? Get out of here. And I left.
Wow. Oh.
I had a little mouth on me. I had fire, right? So that hurt so much, knowing that the hard work, the sacrifice and stuff, and this guy who don't know anything about me going to tell me it's over, this and that, let's move on, whatever, right? Didn't do his homework. Top six is on a relay squad. There's a glimmer of hope, folks, right? I got Jesus. I don't know what he's got. Right? I'm coming. So anyway, make a long story short, you know, I showed him the gold medal when I came back. What can I tell you?
And what was his response?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to doubt you. I said, listen, man, people are going to doubt me. Girls are bigger than I am. Girls got bigger muscles than I am, right? But I said, one thing I know for a fact, my passion, my vision, my dream, I'm coming. I ain't going to stop me, right? It's about planning, about timing, and there's going to be obstacles, right? And I remember even that year with so many injuries and I fired my coach at the time, because he went from a coach to a manager and taking all my money and taking everything that was given to me, right? And I had a great lawyer, my Italian lawyer, Massimino, and he brought me in his office and he taught me everything about legality, paperwork and stuff. And he says, what do you want to do with this guy? I said, well, we're going to get rid of him. And I called him up and said, listen, you're fired. But in return, because you've coached me for 4 years, I will give you a plane ticket, all expense stuff paid to come to Atlanta, and you can witness and enjoy that piece. Wow. That's up to you, right? But I'll take care of that, but I don't want to have nothing else to do with you after that. Pride kicks in, I don't want to go. And I say, hey, keep my money, put it in the trust, we're good, right? But it was a challenging moment, but the great news about the planning process for that was I kept a diary of everything. I knew when I got injured, when I don't get injured, and the different things I was doing. So in the year leading up, I was able to modify as much as possible to minimize that injury time and restructure some stuff to be able to make it happen because I kept a complete diary and a blueprint of my training log.
Now, as you move forward, and you coach yourself quite effectively, obviously, but you move forward and you're the Olympic team alternate. And at that point, you showed a really good example of how a person can conduct themselves when things just don't go your way. For, you know, we all people experience, you know, setbacks and disappointments. Maybe you don't get promoted, you don't get your deal or whatever it is. But, and this is a quote that kind of reflects how it was for you at the time. That was a very, very difficult situation, excuse me, for me to watch. I was running the fastest times after the trials. To go through the warm-ups with the guys, it was like the knife was turned in my heart. It hurt. I looked up at the sky and said, Jesus, I'm going to look to leave it to you and let you rectify the situation. Now, you felt like afterwards, you say you'd earned your spot. And I spoke to your teammate, Glenroy Gilbert, and I wanted to play this. It's about you. And I think it was a really good kind of summary of things from kind of different perspectives. So we'll have a listen here.
Of course, you had us at the Olympic Games in 1996. And unfortunately, Carlton ran two rounds of that race and then got it, sustained an injury. And then Robert, sitting on the sideline, who would never have run, ends up being interjected into that race and was the very linchpin that we needed to win gold. Because do I think that we would have won if Robert wasn't in there? I don't think so. I don't think so. I honestly don't. And that's not taking anything away from Carlton. It's not taking anything away because, again, Carlton ran two rounds beforehand. This is just a guy with fresh legs coming in and infusing a level of enthusiasm, a level of speed, and matching the Americans, which is really what we were looking for. I mean, we all ran well. We all ran better than we ran the two rounds before. But the guy who led off was really the guy that the fuse. He lit the fuse. That was the guy that started it. Because without that, I don't think we would have won.
So, you know, and that's the guy you pass the baton to. And he's saying in another part of the interview, he says that you really showed hunger. So for those that are looking, you know, to overcome, you know, a disappointment or maybe they want to advance or get promoted, next opportunity, whatever it is, you work through that disappointment with a knife in your heart, you're saying. And you stayed ready. And so what is that? How did you prepare yourself and make yourself ready in such a obviously just emotional, you know, difficulty?
You know, that Olympics was very taxing emotionally, psychologically on me, with the politics and the stuff happening from the leadership. Should have never happened to me or any other athletes, which you'll know a little bit more later on in my book, The Naked Truth, coming out sometime next year. With the lessons, and I've always said, no matter what I do in life, job, sports, whatever, everything that I do or everything that happens must have a purpose, must have a meaning. And I must be able to learn from it somehow, everything that I do. So with learning that lesson, and I remember the rounds, the rounds was the killer, because a coach came to me in the first round and says, how are we going to do? And I give him the exact place position, exact times that they ran, and exactly what the American was going to do at the exact time they were going to run in each round. I remember after the semifinal, he looked at me and says, what do you know that I don't know? Why are you so accurate? Right? And I said, I understand biomechanics. I understand behaviors. I understand the mental stress. I understand all the pieces, the wind, the different things, elements outside of what's happened. I'm able to see things and feel things that you can't, right? I have that. People said, do I have 5 cents? I said, no, I have 6. Because I have certain levels when I'm in a mental calm and a mental balance, I can see so many things at slow paces, but while it's moving so fast. And I said, you're dead tomorrow. I know that for a fact. You ain't going to win. You ain't going to come close. And I remember when I said,
that's not bitterness. Thing. You're just speaking facts.
No, I'm just being facts. And yeah, I do all the numbers. I have to do all the numbers. Okay. Right? And I said to myself, when all that was going down, I said, you know what? I'm going to leave this to God. I said, God, you've never failed me yet. You helped me at the Olympic trials. You helped me to run the third fastest time during the Olympic re-ranking to put me third ranked. Right, right. So I'm the third fastest going into the relay.
That's right.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to leave it to you. And I, when they called a meeting and says, you know, I remember Glenn Roy says, well, we can't win without Robert. I remember Bruni says, we can't win without Robert. So right away, that's two votes against others. So now if I vote, it's three. You're outnumbered. Right? And the first reaction was for me to go ramble. But I caught my tongue and I said, you know what? And I looked up and I said, thank you for the opportunity and the blessings. I'm prepared. Every morning, I got up 6 a.m. and trained because the first run was 9 a.m. So I had to make sure I go through all the process and prepare for that opportunity because I said, it will happen. I wanted it to happen from round one. But one thing I learned in life is human time and God time is two different times. What we want as human being, we're greedy, we want things now, we're now people. But his time is a different time span. So if you learn and understand what he wants and his time span, then you have a greater time, more chance for success. Sometimes we rush things and get greedy. So I stayed back and allowed the process to happen. But through that process, I said, what can I learn through that process? I watched John Drummond, I watched certain things, I watched the crowd, I watched all the pieces. So I said, you know what? I'm going to create an opportunity and maximize that opportunity. And that's when I started branding. And that's when I started take over the whole process because the Olympics usually have about five big stories. Michael Johnson, Mary Perrette, 100 meter, Carl Lewis ninth gold medal. And nobody busts the fifth story. So I said, I'm going to turn fifth story about Robert. So I decided what is important. And I went to bed and I was envisioning everything. And as soon as I got up, I started writing on the paper and it says blast off. So I said, what does blast off mean? And I said, blast is to start, off is to finish. In here, we got some substance in the middle. And I said, for us to win, we have to win and to become Mr. Blast Off. So I went to the hair guy and I said, by the way, I need someone to cut this and carve this in my hair. I go, yeah, I'm Jamaican. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, I'm Jamaican, half Jamaican, American. I'm like, all right, you might have some chance here. So I put Relay Blast Off and I put it in my hair. And I said, okay, if I can take this, it will capture what the fifth story about. It able to give me that fresh legs. And yes, it was an ugly haircut, but it got the message across. I remember someone from Japan came in and take a picture. Hi-ya! You're going to be famous. I'm like, thank you. I am. Thank you. Right? And for that photo alone, I know it's going to create magnitude.
Yeah.
I called Peter Thompson, one of the greatest photographers out there. And I said, this is what I have planned. I need to take a picture. And I called Ron and I said, Ron McLean, this is what I'm going to do. And I set those two only of what it should look like. And I remember when I show and I put the bandana on and everything, and the night before I wore the shirt Arnold Schwarzenegger gave from the movie before called Eraser. And on the back of it, I wanted to let John Drummond know I'm about to erase you. So I packed that shirt specifically to wear. So, and it's on the back of it, it says, relax, you've been erased. So I walked past him and he stopped and he read it and said, relax, you've been erased. And I said, yes. Because at that moment, on paper, I am not the fastest man out there. But I know for a fact, if I can control your mental state and remove you from some of your focus, it gives me a better opportunity to come in and sneak it out. So when he read that, I knew he was now the focus. I got him where I want him. And then when we went through the dugout and going through the stadium, I'm going to put the nail in the coffin with him now. Because when I walked out and I took off my hat, Peter took a picture. And right away, all of a sudden, my head's on the big jumbo screen, both of them. And the stadium started wondering what the hell is on this kid's head. Which is, right? It sounds like a beehive.
Yeah.
Until the camera started focusing on the lens. And then they start going around. And I remember it sounds so awesome. was like hooked on phonics, and they all read it at the same time. Relay blast off. I'm like, yes. Now we need to win to become Mr. Blaster.
Yeah.
And John Drummond didn't like that because now he's a crowd pleaser. I just silenced him and took the crowd
over. Oh, this is by design.
Yeah. The crowd, he plays off the crowd. But I have a tendency, I can control the crowd better than he can. So I took the crowd away from him. And now he don't know what to do because I got the power now. Right? So now that he's defocused, it'll give me a better chance to man him leg by leg. Right? Because if he's got the energy, he's going to run away with it. Right? And I know he's faster on paper. But I know if I can control him mentally, we're going to have some evenness out. Right? So he was a lane ahead of me. And at that time, I said, you know what, Dad, I never had a chance to race you. And I dreamt about him the night before. I said, I'm going to put you in John's lane. And I'm going to use John, my dad, to race my dad to try to beat my dad, which is John, to keep me relaxed at the same time and focus. Right?
So you dreamed about your dad the night before?
The night before, he appeared in my dream for the first time since he passed away. Right? He says, don't worry, I'll be there at the race. And I said, how am I going to know? And the crazy thing is, when I was going through the dugout, I remember it was about 20-something degrees. That day, when I was going through, my temperature dropped about minus. I couldn't move. I don't know if you ever, when you're dreaming, and you feel like somebody's choking and you want to scream and you can't scream, and something happening, that's what happened. And then all of a sudden, I felt warmth through my body. My temperature went back up, and I'm like, okay, you're here. And that's when I knew he was in the presence. And I'm like, all right, Dad, it's time to go have some fun. Time to go get this victory. So I put him up there in lane 7 up top ahead of me, right? So I can keep an eye on him and lock him in, right? So I wasn't thinking of John at that time now. I'm thinking I'm going to race my dad. Like, one of my childhood dreams was to race my dad, which I didn't get the opportunity. Okay. But now it showed up in my dreams and in spirit. I'm like, race time, right? So all those processes been planned out and put in place and strategically making moves. See, a lot of times, even my relay team, I'm trying to tell them the whole process.
Yeah.
They're not listening. I said, how you think I outperform you how many times? I said, I'm probably one of the few people who beat how many world record holders in a race, right? Because I'm only 5'7", I say 5'9", but about 5'7". And I have to think and train beyond your regular athlete.
Yeah.
Right? I have to think my muscle has to be like a golf ball instead of a tennis ball. Okay. I have to think of the surface I'm going to land on. I have to think of the wind I'm going to move in. I have to think of everything surrounding. So when I'm competing, I'm thinking of all the elements. How am I going to adapt and adjust my technique, my speed to be able to perform based on how small I am? To be able to sprint like I'm 6'2" and sustain that. So things I mid-distance work I don't care for, I have to do to be able to hold my top-end speed to give myself a chance to perform and beat them at that time, right? And I want to beat them when they're at their best, not when they're running bad, because to me that's not performance. I want to outperform them, right? I get last long as I run a personal best. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, right? Okay.
So, yeah, those were some of the process of the planning and execution of becoming Blastoff.
There's something incredible. There's many things incredible, but there's a series of things that kind of add up and make this very curious to me, which is that, you know, you're the alternate looking for an opportunity. It's your first Olympics. The team had not been running well through the heats. Carlton is hurt, and now you're chosen. And I would think, you know, a person, many people stepping into this role might be conservative and just think, I'm just going to run a clean race and not screw up. I'm not going to ruin the medal. But you really embraced it and you showed unbelievable confidence by shaving that in your head. Your teammate Glenn Roy says, Robert, what'd you do to your head? You didn't even tell your teammates.
No.
And the t-shirt, and that was all. So what was going through your mind to show so much confidence and such a bravado to help the team?
I saw the rounds where the fun wasn't there anymore. I saw a lot of business.
Oh.
Money, this, that was happening on the outside of the ROM. And I said, for you to be at your best, I want them to go back to the area of fun. And that's part of the haircut. Because I know when they see the haircut, I know they're going to laugh. I know Donovan's going to call me a clown and slap me as usual, right? But although he may do that, on my mind, it's where I wanted him. Because I saw the fun piece and the relaxed piece that I'm looking for. I saw the smile on Glenroy's face. Like, this guy is gone another level. I saw Bruni laughing. He's at another level. At that moment, that was the reaction I'm looking for. Because I wanted to feel like we're on the playground at school when we're playing tag.
Okay.
That energy system, that nervous system, that energy system is one of the purest you'll find without any corruptive stuff happening. And that's what I wanted to see leading into the finals. That pure fun, catch me if you can, type of concept, right? That fun, that playfulness. So when we walked into the finals and the Ghana team decide they're going to come back and with the same running, when you pull them out, you can't bring them back in. And that 20-minute delay almost jeopardized all the plans that I had in place because timing is everything. Because now showtime was supposed to go at a certain time. Now you're delayed by 20, 30 minutes. Muscles are not warmed up anymore. The focus start lacking. So if you notice, every about a couple minutes, I'm putting my hands up. That means when I see they put their hand up, then I know they're still on the same page while we get through this 20, 30 minutes. We're still locked in. So it was important that I go back and forth to see everybody's, are we still good? We're still good, right? Because we have to do check-in while others start panicking, right? Because I know that piece now become a psychological piece. And during those moments, I always say 70 to 90% of performance in those times is about mental. Because if it's got to do with physical and stuff, you shouldn't be there. You should be prepared already. So it has to be a mental, and it's a reverse. You go train, right? The tough one, you try to get through the 30% mentally, the last one. But over here, it's all about mental. Because if you're physically not prepared, you should not be there. Right? So now it's a psychological advantage. Who's stronger mentally can take over.
And so you're looking for something not only that can throw off John Drummond, and you ran very well against him, but also you were trying to find something that could enhance your team.
Exactly. And they didn't know that. Because once again, you can ask the coach, what do I know that he doesn't know? That was a question, right? And this is what I was able to do on the back end, which they don't realize, my masterpiece behind. Everybody see Robert as a clown and a somewhat an idiot because he's the kid. I'm the youngest of the team, so he's the kid. But they don't see the logical side, my planning process as a child coming all the way through. Everything that I'm doing, there's a plan process for success, right? And it's a great thing is when I'm working with these young athletes, and that's why I always say, let's train the mind first before the body. Because if I can strengthen the mental piece, by the time you get to the championships, we're good. I said, I don't care what you lose before then. I said, we show up a championship to perform. Period. Then why are you going to a championship? Focus, lock in, I'm a therapist, everybody coming. It's like a Formula One pit crew. We're here to perform at a high level and go home. That's what we train for. So it's the same thing. I train the mind early and monthly and weekly and build that up. When we go up to championship, my son was willing to race a kid that's older than him.
Yeah.
6 years old and ready to battle.
Yeah.
Because I named him Ryan for a reason.
Yeah. Right? So I understand a little bit better when you say plan, purpose, and passion. When you say plan, I thought it was more like I have a race plan, let's say. But you're thinking even bigger. You mean like
you have to
think like a higher level and put it towards your passion, your purpose. That's what I'm getting now.
You got to think like a CEO. Everything you do, you're the CEO, right? You got to think like a CEO. You need to save money. You need to invest. You need to expand when you need to expand. You need to cut and make tough decisions. All that when I'm doing whatever I'm doing, I've always think of myself as the CEO. And anything, here's a project. I'm the CEO of this project. I'm going to make it happen. What was the vision? Let's move backwards and start execute. But knowing we could go off rail, we need to come back and regroup and get back on track. Right? So no matter what we do, and that's why I tell the kids, I said, listen, when you train with Air Blastoff, I'm going to teach you things on and off the track or on and off the field to allow you to make decisions within the classroom, within the business. I said, when you come through speed 101, which I call it the university 101, because it takes about 4 or 6 years, I can make an Olympian. Right? Wow. If you got half decent talent and you're coachable, I'll take you there in 6 years because I've done it myself. I'm not asking you to do things that I've never done or experienced. I'm giving you my blueprint, which I've done it in 6 years. So don't tell me it can't be done in 6 years. People tell me 10, 15 years, I've done it in six. I probably could have done it quicker too with the right people around me.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So overall, plan, purpose, and passion. You know, you need to have a plan. You need to, I always say, if your passion is there, and I said to kids, if you don't have the passion right now, it's okay. I'm going to invest a year in you. But within a year, you better come up with a passion. Because if not, you're wasting my time.
Yeah.
But at least you're going to learn some stuff within a year.
Right.
If you develop that passion in a year, woo, we're flying. If you got the passion early, we're moving quickly. Right? You know, so it's crazy. And with some of those, you're going to get some pushbacks from different people because they don't see their vision. Right? And I always try to pick people around me, mentors older than I am, has wisdom in different areas, and I try to learn from them and try not to make those mistakes because it costs. So if I try to learn from them, then my investment of cost of risk becomes less. Then I can learn more and move faster and get to where I want, safer and faster.
To the race itself, I wanted to ask you about something, and it's one of there's two kind of, aside from the race itself, there's kind of two moments that stand out. And one of them is when Bruni Surin hands it to Don Bailing and he sticks his hands in the air. It's like he knows. And you run the first leg and you pass it to Glenn Roy and you stick your hand up in the air. But what I discovered as I did research is it's for a different reason you did this.
Yeah.
And so we'll play it here and you're getting ready to go at this point. That's John Drummond and you feel like you've gotten in his head and you ran a great, and this is from Robert Esme, your Robert Esme blast off 1996 in on YouTube here. But, and you ran a great first leg and then the handoff is there's a moment there and there you go. There's John and there's the handoff. And right there, your arm goes up.
Yeah.
And so what was that about? Because it as I read, it's actually not about the race and it's not about the race itself even. It's something deeper. I suppose it's the purpose part of your three Ps, I suppose.
It was to, one, the delivery is made. I gave it a FedEx-style delivery, safe.
Yeah.
Secondly, after that, it was to signal the rest of the teammate the baton is now safe in their hands and it's your turn. That was the signal of it. That it's on its way. All right. It's delivered. It's on its way. Go get it. All right. That was the intention of that. It's delivered. Go get it, baby. Go get it. He did blast off.
when you passed it to Glenn Roy and when we talked to Glenn Roy, he was saying he ran, it might have been the fastest his body had ever moved, is what he's saying. And he says about you that he left his mark early because he could see you were running with incredible pace.
Well, don't forget the energy that was bottled up based on the scenarios and everything that was planned. That's why I said I took that energy from John. I take his energy and I use it to elevate. When you look at that relay, it's the fastest each member has ever ran their legs. And some people don't realize the first leg is the longest leg of that relay. Okay. By the time it was handed off, it's about 112 meters or so. And depends on the speed or whatever. I think the second furthest leg might have been Glenn Roy. The third shortest, it would have been Bruni, and the shortest would have been Donovan, maybe about 80 something meters by the time he received the baton. Right? So when you're thinking of, I think it was 10:34, Iran and that split, you have to think that 10:34 was 112 meters.
That's an excellent time. Excellent.
Right? So when people say, oh, we only ran 10 something, by the time the baton was handed off, it was about 112 meters. So when you hear us say Donovan ran 8 point something. Yes, he's running about 70, 80 meters. Hello. Right? When you hear 9 point something, based on where it's hand off and where it's delivered, you have to do that distance and see what was that distance like. Right? So based on that, it was a phenomenal race just to battle with John. Oh, I love battling with him. Oh, yeah, I get any man. I could still be on my sofa right now, and it could be Usain Bolt. I said, no man on this planet can beat me from 0 to 40. None. Ben Johnson will tell you, every time I leave that blocks from 0 to 40, I'm at a world record, every time. What happens after that? No. But 0 to 40? I'm like a clock machine coming out of war. Even now, right? I train professional athletes.
Yeah, yeah.
I want them to warm up. They're talking smack. I'm like, listen, man. Line up here, man. I'll start with 10 meters. If you can beat me for 10, you get free training. Boom! I'm like, give me my money, man. Give me my money.
Awesome. And after the race, there's a couple of very interesting moments. And the first is, immediately after you finish, you grab Carlton Chambers, the injured athlete, who had been running the first leg before. You immediately grabbed him as a teammate, which I thought was very interesting in light of the fact that you felt you deserved it, and you felt kind of like maybe wrong, maybe disrespected. I might be overreaching here, but there were some tough feelings there. And the knife through the heart. And yet immediately after you finished, you went to go grab him, which I thought said really something about team and how you approach the team. So what was that about? And how did you go forward with that?
I'm a spiritually sound person. I wouldn't, right? Man of faith. I don't dislike anyone. What happened was a bad situation from a bad leadership of the team. I love Carlton, right? I love all my teammates. I'll be there for them anytime they need me.
Okay.
During that moment after that run, first thing I wanted to do was say, thank you, Jesus, for giving me the opportunity. Preparation equals opportunity equals success. Right? Second thing I wanted to do was to go grab my baton and put it back in my bag because it was mine to begin with. I took it out of my bag for the race. Right? And I knew the value of that baton. It's the only one that's ever going to be the American, and it's mine. I got it before the race, and it's going to be mine after the race. So I make sure right away I got it and put it back, and then I had planned to make sure everybody signed it before I leave the stadium, so which was done. The third thing I wanted to do was I wanted to grab Carlton. One thing you have to understand, when it comes to teamwork, our goal was to win a gold medal. It doesn't matter how we did it or how we got there. It took 5-6 men. It's important that whoever ran, five of us, should be able to celebrate at the same time and run around the track. So although the security guards in there want to stop us, I don't care. We're going to bring you in. Because at the end of the day, if the baton drops, he's going to be heartbroken the exact same amount we are. And if we win, he's supposed to celebrate the exact amount that we did. So my job, I thought, with my values and upbringing and common sense, you go grab him and make sure he's part of that piece, because it's a moment in time that will never be repeated. Everything happens that day, that week, that month, that hour, that second will never be repeated. And I wanted to make sure he's part of whatever that piece of that moment is, to be enjoying that moment with us four that ran that night, including its contribution that he did with those other rounds. Because he got us to the finals, no matter injury or not, right? He got us there. And it's important that he was celebrated the same way, because what they did to me leading up to there should have never happened, because I earned that position. And I'm not going to use that to bitter to punish anyone. That would be childish and selfish, and that wasn't the value that I grew up with my mother would probably smack the black off of me back then. Right? And she is a martial artist and she goes by Blackie Chang. So, right? So overall, I wanted to make sure those three things in my heart was done and I can sleep at night knowing that.
Talking about, you had a straight talk with Glenroy about how, about passing the baton and your quarter saying, listen, Glenroy, I'm going to speak to you man to man. I know I can pass a baton in my sleep. I sleep with a baton. Yeah. I know where your hand will be every time. So let's correct it and be focused. I said my piece. And so it seems like, you know, communication, part of being this team is, you know, what we know is that, you know, there were some personalities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that the team was able to work through those things. So how does like really direct, strong communication, how's that look in a high-performing team to you?
It's huge. When I'm dealing speeches in corporate world from investors to Royal Bank to work with CEOs and different people, athletes from grassroots all the way through, whatever it is, I give them this key importance. And I learned that from the relay. One bad handoff can ruin an entire race. And the concept is within there, you need to have trust. All right. One of my biggest fear in the relay was there was a trust factor between Bruni and Glenroy. Sorry, Bruni and Donovan. Donovan,
right.
He's accustomed to turning around.
Okay.
That's his, what he's accustomed to, his style that he likes to run. And of all, and we always said, listen, try to trust a little bit more because you're going to get more out of it once the trust is bonded, where mm-hmm. if you don't turn around and trust him to get you the baton, we're going to run faster.
It's a sign of trust.
But it's a habit of turning.
Yeah.
And you can't revert an habit overnight in a sense. He's done a lot better as we got along where he's turned around less, right? Because also with the strong personality of us, we're all leaders. And it's very difficult for all leaders to say, hey, I may not want to lead this one. You lead this one. Right? Or you may be off a day, you take up the notch that day and help bring the team home. So it's very difficult for leaders in a room to be able to figure that out and gel together. So trust was one, clear communication is the next. Right? And here's an example. I know there was an argument, we're going to say stick. Okay? And the concept was we need to change it because maybe seven idiots teams going to say stick on the track.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's 60,000 people screaming. Our tone and our vocabulary and the language, when you say stick, that's five letters, right? So just like the movie Lost in Translation, when everybody says stick together, it sounds like a mumbo jumbo. So when you're moving at a high velocity, which we travel probably anywhere between 38 to 50 kilometers per hour, and you say stick, it shortens the diaphragm and the breath of breathing. So we said, let's come up with the word high. So for instance, work with me, say stick.
Stick.
Say hi.
Hi.
Say stick.
Stick.
Say hi.
Hi.
Now I want to say it louder with more passion. Stick.
Stick.
Hi.
Hi.
What did you know works harder, the stick or the high?
Stick feels like it works harder.
And the diaphragm.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to relax the diaphragm so it can breathe. So all this I'm thinking. So when we change it to high, it's two letters. So I've just saved you 0.3 seconds in a sense. We're taking from 5 to 3. So if you times that 3 times the baton passed around, we'll just save you a whole bunch of time.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of time in my mind. Then I'm thinking, if we say hi, the other seven idiots are going to say stick, so ours is different. When we're traveling and we say hi and it goes through the air, it takes less time for hi to travel for you to hear it. So by the time you hear it and reciprocate and release your hand, it takes time. Stick takes a longer time to travel for you to hear it and react. So all this I'm thinking. Right? So now I said, okay, we're going to save some time there for the relay. How can we save more time? I said, oh, the stick is 12 inches. So I'm going to start with the baton in my right hand and hold three. I'm going to make sure when I give it to Glenroy, he's going to get the other three exactly. So I save six. So if I can do this, and if you pass it off each time, we just save 18 inches. So 18 inches, you can win and lose a race. So now we just save more time on there. So all this, when I was sitting out, I'm learning all the pieces to put them all back together for race time, show time, right? So, and then if we started splitting the track. So if we start in my right hand, Glenroy receiving his left because it's rhythm. Once in rhythm, once in motion, once in stay in motion. He does not change the baton. He passed the baton from his left to Bruni's right. So we're staggering on the track so we can split the track and minimize any cutting on stepping on the track at all times. So that way the hands are directly across the track because now we're running. We need to deal with the visual aspect of it now. So if the eyes move and the hands low, my eyes are going to go low. That means my speed will decrease because I have to adjust to be able to go down to give them the baton. So the hands has to be at eye level. So when I'm sprinting and running, I can see it directly and pass it off in that direct spot because my hand's already here. So why am I going to run and drop it here when it's here? Just release it. So all those pieces we have to change to see how we can decrease our time to have a chance for a gold medal. Who knows, we'd have broke some records along the line. So those were the concept when you're thinking of corporate, sports, teamwork, school. When you're working together as a team and as a leader, you have to look at all the pieces. How are we going to get better? Who's good at what? Who can contribute? Where are some of your weaknesses? Where are some of your strengths? How are we going to make this successful for that one common goal of success? And ours was the gold medal. Restore Canada's pride. And feel great that we contribute to Canadian history.
And congratulations again. And these are fascinating. And so the team made changes. This wasn't during Atlanta. It was all throughout, I assume.
It was during Atlanta.
You made all these changes during Atlanta?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right? But there was a whole bunch of stuff happening before, even the following year after that. And that's when I realized I need to take more control. So I need to work harder. And then now I changed the concept is I want the world record. Right? So now my passion and desire even more greater. So the 97, the World Championship trials was in Vancouver and I was living in Vancouver. And I made a statement, and I don't regret it, because I love Bruni. I grew up with Bruni. I love Bruni. He was like my brother. I used to talk to Bruni every day. We go to camps together. We do everything together. Oh. And that's probably one thing that I miss the most is my relationship that I had with him. Okay. Right? I remember at the World Indoor, I said to Bruni, I said, you have tremendous ability to be a world record holder. And sometimes my honesty and my blunt is a fault as well. And I said, you need to stay in your own den, right? Don't go over to the other camp, which they wanted, because if you go to the other camp, it's not designed for you. And it won't put you in an opportunity to be the world record holder, which I know you're capable of. But I'm also capable of the world record holder. And I said, after the World Indoor, I said, if you're not careful, I'm going to outperform all of you guys at the championships. He thought I was joking. But yet, it was intense. Word got out that I have a dartboard in my house. And then I have every man picture on my dartboard, and I play dart with them all nights. And who's going to get knocked off first, second, and third, or whatever. And I remember they showed up to Vancouver. And that year, I'm running 150 meters back-to-back within 3 minutes rest in 14.5. I'm running 100-meter hand time in 9.3. There is nobody right now is going to touch me. That tells me I'm on a pace for 9.6 electronically. All right? My little me. Yeah. I was bouncing like a gazelle. I remember when they all came in and we had the press conference, they said, oh, Robert's a clown. He doesn't know anything he's talking about. So I remember, I think it was Glenn Roy, and had my first round with me. Didn't know what happened. It's like, what the boom, took off, left everybody. I saw Bruni say, what the hell? I saw Donovan start getting worried, and this is the world record holder. I remember when he came into the finals, Abbotsford, it was about 7,000 people standing, like people hanging against rafters, everything, right? The energy was high. I was in lane 3. Every man coming in. This was Donovan's first big race before, after his world record. I said, well, some people call me clown. We're going to see who's the clown. And I got the new hair stuff and the cape and everything ready to go, right? I remember the false start. I took 2 steps and I was at the finish line. That's how the energy was flowing. I walked back. The starter's like, hurry up. I'm like, listen, man, I'm tired. I took 2 steps, but the engine was just moving. So anyway, I gather myself and compose, and I can see them eyes are just, this guy's in a different level of fitness. And I always say, when you're fit, you can be in shape, but when you're fit, you do superhuman things.
Okay.
And I came out of the blocks. Nobody was around. 40 meter, I didn't even hear them. 60, I'm controlling the race.
Yeah.
80, I hear Donovan. Oh, God, here goes another Carl Lewis on me. Because he's got the long legs like a stretch limousine.
Yeah.
And I know he's puffing and puffing back over there, like ready to blow the doors down. And I saw his legs, and I remember I sort of leaned in, and I put my hand up, and I looked over, but I knew he got me because he's 6-something. So his height and me, because I was like this ahead. But when his body dipped, dipped in front of me.
Yeah.
I knew I didn't win, but he didn't know he won. And the crowd lost it, and I'm playing it up, right? Because here comes the psychological thing. After that, we were supposed to go to eat. Nobody wants to go eat. Nobody wants to talk. People are scratching from the 200 meter because I'm like, bring the 200 now. I'm even more angry now to take it out on them. The first round, annihilated everybody. I only ran 150 meter, walk across the line. I ran 20.7 or something like that. Everybody else, 21 point whatever. I was just, because remember, I'm running 150s and 14 point. There's nobody going to come close, right? It was TV thing. We had to go right away in 10 minutes. I know nobody's in that type of shape, right? Because once again, I'm doing them back to back. So I'm preparing all scenarios. Oh, I pretty much, after 180, I just walked across the line. It was over. People were like, annihilated. And then I went home. I came off the bed and punctured my big toe. Once again, I should have listened to my mother. Clean your room. Why your room so messy? Brand new spikes. Punctured it.
Oh, no.
Couldn't walk for 3 weeks. Went straight into the world championships and ran 10-2s all over the lane. No training for 3 weeks. And that's the year I was ready to break that world record. Ever since then, I couldn't get my body back into that level of fitness. All right, but to tell you, the mental, the preparation, except the execution of cleaning my room, I can't hear my mama.
So you, when you coach your athletes now, you deliver regular motivational videos, and you assign reading, and the mental side is very not just to you, but for you to convey to your athletes. And I'm wondering, you know, what are the types of things that you try to convey to your athletes, you know, that we might be able to learn, those of us that aren't sprinters, aren't athletes, but that maybe carry some universal value?
I do it the same thing in corporate as well as the athletes. When I plan for the athletes, I plan a year out. And each month is a different theme. And then each practice and each week to start the practice, I play a YouTube inspirational video based on that topic that I'm want to achieve. So, and then each month it changes, and that growth, it leads into a championships. So everything emotionally, mentally, and visualization and bringing them on a journey. Because I tell them, when we go to a championship, it's to perform. Don't waste your parents' money. Don't waste your time. Don't waste my time. We're not here to play around. We're here to perform. All right? So I don't care if you get last, but you're going to perform. Because back in my days, you don't perform, you walk home.
Yeah, yeah.
All right? Toronto's a long walk. All right? So overall, it's important to set the tone. I remember when we got locked down and COVID, my staff, I went on and I gave them weekly assignment as well. And different book summaries. And then we get together each and every week and we talk about that book summary. And how does this apply to your business? How does it apply to your personal life? And what growth can you get out of it? And each week, it blows my mind, man. I cry like a baby sometimes. That's because amazing. To see the growth in them and where they want to go, right? So now I'm in the mental retirement stage as well as giving back to society more. Because in my life, there was three things that I wanted: to be an Olympic champion, check. Great father, check. And a great businessman, all right? So I'm going back into the business side. And within that business side, when I'm retired, is to make sure, do more of the things that I love, the charity work, the different things, and give back. So, and then teach the kids the same thing. And that's where my next 25 years is about to lead into, is to make sure the son's good, giving back, and run the business so I can remove myself from the business more and do more of my other passions in life.
What's been the role of faith in your career and as you move through, you know, not just sports, but in business as well?
You know, I grew up in Jamaica. I mean, you know, the faith, we love things. I grew up with my grandma for many years as a child, when my mom was here building stuff for us. And my grandfather is Baptist. My grandmother is Seventh-day Adventist. So Saturday from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., I'm in church till sun goes down. Sunday morning, I'm in church by 10 a.m. till 1 o'clock. So I said I was churched out. A lot of church growing up as a child. I moved to Canada and went to the Christian world with my mom and dad. So I grew up with many different style of religion. And I come up in my philosophy over the years. And my mom and I, that's where we butt heads at times. Right? I said, Mother, you taught me not to touch the stove. I listened. Great. I didn't get burned. You want to tell me different things about the faith and Bible. And I said, the issue that I have is majority of the faith has similar concept, the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not lie. So for me, I operate within those 10 realm of commandment of the majority of the religions. And I try to live within those. I said, on a good year, I probably do about 8, 9 out of 10. In a bad situation, I'm at 5. And when I get to that 5, that's when I have problems. Right? So I would have to say the person that pretty much in my life that would have lived the 10 out of 10 that I've seen was my grandmother.
Okay.
Other than that, I haven't seen anybody come close. I always say make decision based on what's right for them. To me, it starts with common sense and some values. If you know deep down it's wrong, right? Something sixth sense, don't do it. So I ask my kids that I work with and my own kids as well, what is character? I don't know, coach. So I give them my definition. I said, character is what do you do when no one is watching? So my son, I said, I'm like Google Earth. When you make a decision and do something, pretend that he's watching you. So what are you going to do? What decisions are you going to make? Same with my daughter. So now she's back in Vancouver. I want to be in her head at all time while I'm here. What would daddy say? I better not do that. Because I tell her I'm always watching. Plus, I have a GPS on her phone. Right? But overall, that's what that guide of faith allows you, the conscience. All right? So I believe in the Ten Commandments, and I work my decisions from there. And I think my next, when I'm wrapping up my 25 years of my giving back, part of those is going to be my Ten Commandments of I want to see world peace. I want to see hunger, taking care of the elderly, the kids. And if one day Mayor Brown decides he wants to hand off the baton back to me to run, I'm open with his leadership and guidance and mentorship. But those, what I'll be running on is based on those 10 commandments, my 10 causes of giving back to society. And if they want to vote for me, they know they're going to win because my philosophy is anything I touch turns to gold. I don't plan to lose.
That is so awesome. And we're gonna look for your name on the ticket. And we're going to look forward to
10 years,
to the book.
10 years. 10 years. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully the book, we're trying to get that ready for next year.
What's the name of the book again?
The Naked Truth. Blast Off to Success with the Naked Truth. Okay. It's going to be uncomfortable for many areas. Nobody really know much about it, but I've spoke to one of my media guy in the movie business. And one chapter, he says, we're going to shoot a movie from it.
What an amazing interview. I've interviewed a number of amazing individuals, a lot of athletes, and I have a background in sports. And what makes sport an interesting microcosm of life, I feel it's kind of this binary aspect of win-loss, black and white, which makes it interesting. But the lessons from sport really truly reflect just real life. And Robert really brought this home for me. Refusing, for instance, to allow someone to deny him his dream when a reporter mocked him, and being bold from the alternate to probably changing the fortunes of the 4x100 team. And again, like, listen to the interviews with Bruni Surin and Glenroy Gilbert about how he brought like fresh legs, says Glenroy. And Robert Esme ran so well against John Drummond on that first leg. And even before that, coming in with a t-shirt, you know, relaxed, you've been erased, just the confidence of the self-confidence and the self-belief of someone in that position. And the whole haircut, I mean, is completely hilarious and so awesome too. And after the gold medal, it's amazing to me, he immediately grabs the runner he's replaced, Carlton Chambers. So just a great teammate as well, and understands how he fits in and the dynamic of the team. And now he's himself become a very accomplished coach, coaching athletes from the NCAA, NFL players, other Olympians. He's called the speed doctor, and there's a reason for that. And when I think back to this interview, it hasn't happened to me for many of my other guests, but he is so charismatic and so hilarious. It just took me right off my script, but in a fantastic way. I could talk to him for hours. And again, the role of faith for him. And I love the P's, the plan, purpose, and passion. Really awesome stuff here. He broke so many barriers to fulfill his purpose. And make sure you follow him on airblastoff.com and robertesme.com. Great stuff there. And we can all break barriers to be who we're meant to be and to fulfill our purpose. And I am a speaker, coach, and trainer about leadership and self-leadership. So we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to me. I'm at www.evolutionofleaders.com. Please like, subscribe, and share. Take care.